Hello and welcome to the Green Minds podcast,
showcasing the science, stories and solutions behind climate change.
Welcome back to another episode of Imperial Business School Green Minds podcast. So I'm here today to chat to you about the human perspective of climate change. In the business world, we often focus on the risks when talking about climate change, whether it's physical or the transition risks. As businesses move towards a triple bottom line of people, planet, and profit, sometimes the people aspect can get left behind. Today, we want to look at climate change from the starting point, from the people on the ground, from across the globe being affected by climate change. How are they responding? By sharing these stories, I hope to inspire persons to look not only at the risk to business, but the risk to human well-being, arguably the main reason why we care about economic development. So today is our Latin America and Caribbean edition, and I have two lovely guests in the room with me, so I'll ask them to kindly introduce themselves.
Yes, thank you. Well, my name is Sofia, and I come from Mexico. I was born and raised there. And I was working before in the financial sector, and then I decided to join this master's at Imperial College called Climate Change Finance and Management, which I very much love. And yeah, it's been very exciting to study about this.
Yeah, so thank you for having us. My name's Ilona. I've grown up in Barbados, but my mum's Argentinian, my dad is French, but I'm mostly Bajan. And beforehand, I was studying at UCL, mostly sustainability and engineering, and I'm now also on the same master's and also really enjoying it.
Awesome. So we want to start off by really getting the what it's been like living in the countries that you're from. So can you tell me a bit about how climate change has already been impacting your home country?
Yeah, sure. Well, I live in Mexico City. So for me, the biggest, I guess, is water scarcity. It's something that is very real, I think, for most of the people living in Mexico City. And I think between drought and flooding is the biggest issues that we have in Mexico City, which is kind of a paradox in a sense, because we're either flooding or we don't have enough water to drink. So I think that's where I can think about it. It's the most visible for the majority of people living there.
And based on your studies so far, do you more understand why there's this paradox, or did you have a good understanding before and now it was just clarifying it?
I mean, not really. I think it's a very complex issue that has a lot of variables, because you have the overpopulation. It's a very densely populated area. So, of course, it's a huge challenge to get enough water to that many households. But I do think that humans have created the situation where there's just too many people in one sole place and there's just not enough water. And then, of course, the flooding from rainfall is getting more and more severe, which I do think that is quite related with climate change.
Interesting. And Ilona, do you think you have the same problems in Barbados, or what's it like in there?
Yeah, so I think there's a really interesting aspect, which is that we have similar problems in terms of lack of water. Barbados is a limestone island. We have no rivers, no lakes, no actual freshwater reservoirs. We only have the water table, and that's been quite poorly managed, I think, in the past. We don't really have flooding in so much as a major issue, although we do also have problems with the infrastructure and occasional kind of coastal inundations, but that's probably more likely to due to sea level rise. So definitely slightly different issues there, overlap with lack of water, but kind of our big one is sea level rise. So
interesting.
Yeah,
great. So obviously you're interested in climate change, and that's why you're doing this master's, but at what point do you think you realize that you'd want to pursue these studies? Is that what shaped your undergrad degree, or was it something you kind of recently stumbled upon?
Yes, yeah, so for me, kind of, as I mentioned previously, I was at UCL and I had the opportunity to kind of choose what I wanted to study. And I decided to go into sustainability and climate change. I think a large part of that is interest garnered from, you know, seeing the impacts in Barbados and at home. Also, my parents are very sustainably minded and so on. But a large part of it for me is innovation. So it's definitely a space where a lot of really intelligent people are making all new technologies, all new decisions. And there's that aspect that I think is quite thrilling of pushing the boundaries to make a real impact.
Yeah, for me, I think it was since I was very young, I've been in a household where they're very environmentally aware and also connected with nature in terms of where we would spend our leisure time and also weekends. And then, yeah, as I grew and started questioning what I wanted to do, I guess it came as a natural to relate nature with whatever I was going to be doing. And since nature is threatened, I thought, why not? I have a bachelor's in business management, where I think there's a lot of opportunities to improve. So I think definitely my childhood and my link to nature is what shaped me to take the decision of studying what I am.
There seems to be a common thread that you've kind of heard about nature and preservation from a very young age through your families. What do you think the challenges are for places that really and truly are quite detached from it and they never hear about these topics from early on? What do you think are the possible solutions to overcome things like this?
I mean, I do definitely think it's a huge challenge in huge urban areas such as, for example, Mexico City, where I think there's just more malls than parks. So there's a lot of people that are detached with it. And it's something that if you want to change it, you should definitely be more connected. However, there's no space and there's no resources sometimes to have nature closer. So, I mean, I was very lucky that I had the opportunity to go in the weekends to places with lakes or mountains or woods, but not everybody is in that situation. So I think it's a lot of stakeholders need to make that possible, but it is very important to make it possible. Otherwise,
I think just building on that, I think there needs to be a distinction between, of course, in an ideal world, everyone is connected and feels that connection and is able to kind of make a change or give back or act in some way. But there's a lot of people who are connected to nature and who live off of that or who have that exposure and are still doing nothing, either because, you know, the tangibility of climate change is still lacking for some or just simply because they don't have the means to do it. You know, I think about Barbados specifically, and definitely there's more and more people doing some really exciting projects and coming up with really new exciting adaptation or mitigation plans. But there's lots of people who can't think about that because economically they just can't make any kind of lifestyle change or contribution. So I think there is a kind of aspect of making it tangible for everyone and also making it clear that you don't need to be economically stable to do even the little things. Whether it is buying your fruit and veg and just saying, you know, hold the plastic bag, I'll just take my canvas bag from home. Even the tiny things count. And so it's not just about connection, but also just making that really tangible. Mm-hmm.
So generally, when the government at your home country would be implementing an environmental policy, what's the general sentiments among the population, you think?
It really depends because, I mean, on the one hand, waste in my country has become a huge business for a lot of people. There's recycling PET, P-E-T, a plastic, it's really profitable. So it has become, for some, a very good opportunity, and the government has let that happen because it just takes away more issues. But on the other hand, it's insufficient. I mean, when we talk about water scarcity, it's something that is a very real problem for a lot of people every single day. So I think the sentiment is it's quite mixed. I mean, there's something being done for sure, but probably not enough and not covering the most priority areas, which is, yeah, having access to clean water every day.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think for Barbados it's quite different. Quite a bit is being done now, but the kind of differing opinions are either I really support this and I want to move forward with this and it makes sense to, or I don't understand why this is being done. That comes also, you know, it's a very complex issue, but the skill set in the Caribbean is quite small. The populations are quite small. So it tends to be, you know, key stakeholders who are doing these projects repeatedly. And I think there can be some pushback when it's always one set of people or one, you know, person, one figurehead, because it's almost seen as like a profitable enterprise. So I think there's some dichotomy there. And also it just depends on the project. So they're planning to build, I think it's like a 7-floor hotel in Barbados, which doesn't sound like a lot, but for a country that has like maximum 2 floors, it's pretty big. And another one that's like 15 floors, so really something colossal, on the coast. And we're already facing severe problems with coastal erosion. So I think, you know, when people look at the 7-floor one, they're like, okay, well, you know, it's making us more globalized, it's feeding into our tourism sectors, we'll let that one slide. And then looking at the 15 kind of floor one and being like, absolutely not, that's way too far, you're damaging our shoreline. But it's at what point then do you draw that line and say, right, you know, 7 is still too much, or not?
Mm-hmm. And that highlights again the importance of having a strategy for that as well. So a tourism adaptation strategy that I think lots of countries are now taking into consideration, especially since that's what makes money for most of the developing countries that depend on that. Sophia, would you like to share an adaptation project happening in Mexico, actually?
Well, yeah, going back to waste and recycling, I think recycling has been a source of a lot of jobs. Probably there's still a lot to do there because there's children doing it and health hazards are quite big. But if you look at it in the positive side of it, there is people that are getting an income out of recycling things that otherwise would have ended up in the landfill, which of course is not enough, the amount of landfills that we have for the population. So yeah, I think we're trying to do as much as we can, but I think a bit of information or more education towards what is the most efficient actions to do is maybe missing. But yeah, in terms of recycling, there's a huge opportunity and a lot of things going on.
And since you're studying in London and Europe, do you think the conversation is more skewed towards mitigation, or do you think adaptation and mitigation are both on the same level here?
That's a good question. I think it depends on who you talk to. I have a lot of friends who have no concept of either, which is quite surprising given that it's such a cosmopolitan, you know, highly educated city for the most part. So I think there's still kind of a gap there in terms of people becoming aware and also becoming aware of the differences, right? So recycling and so on is kind of an easier one. But I talk to my flatmate sometimes about certain aspects of mitigation or adaptation strategies, and he's just curious about the strategy itself, you know, and not necessarily concerned about where it fits. But I think if I was to give like an overall opinion, I think people are more likely to talk about mitigation methods simply because they're maybe the easier ones to think about, I suppose.
So for our listeners who aren't sure what adaptation and mitigation are, could you quickly just give a one-sentence synopsis of each?
Well, to my understanding, mitigation is more addressing the root of the problem, which is greenhouse gas emissions, right? So it's targeted to cut our emissions of carbon so we don't end up having a warmer climate. And adaptation is, as the word says, adapting to this warmer world. So if this warmer world is going to cause sea level rise, how are we going to deal with that? Are we going to build walls around our cities? Are we going to build further away from the shoreline? So yeah, I think one of them is addressing the root of the problem, and the other one is sort of like managing the consequences of the problem. However, in my opinion, it's a joint effort of both how to tackle climate change, and we shouldn't solely think that one of them is an absolute solution. It's both of them that are going to get us out of this problem.
Sure, and if I can just add one tiny thing on that, it's of course, you know, the biggest thing that we think about is emissions, but it's also changing climate generally. So mitigating any kind of changes in that climate, and again, adapting to any kind of changes. So whether that's increased rainfall or, you know, increased drought in some areas, that also falls in within the two and different terms, just depending on whether you tackle the root or whether you just try to keep living with that new situation.
Talking about living with the new situation, the IPCC 1.5 special report that's available for all to read, by the way, suggests that even if we limit global warming to 1.5 degrees, and we're already at 1, about 70% of the coral reef systems in the Caribbean wouldn't make it. How does that make you feel, coming from Barbados?
Yeah, it's pretty horrible. I was actually thinking about this yesterday as like a really just kind of hit home moment. I can't imagine not growing up without coral reefs. I know it sounds very exotic, and I'm very lucky, but there's definitely, and you can already see it in Barbados, there's definitely a downhill trend in terms of the growth of the species, the survival, the amount of fish that are able to kind of live on the reefs. I was actually looking at a really interesting adaptation project that's going on in Barbados. It's artificial reefs. So it's not the same thing as corals, but at least it maintains to some extent the ecosystem. And my dad's really involved with a non-profit in Barbados called Coral, and they're essentially replanting coral. And that just makes them more resilient. But of course, if we continue emitting at the rate that we're emitting, you know, as much as we can try, they're not going to survive our lifetimes.
Yeah, I feel like we're at a very desperate point, and that's the importance of you guys here today to share the stories and really bring to light how climate change is impacting people's well-being and happiness. And, you know, that's really the point of why we care about development and growth. So would you guys like to share any last stories with us? Any last comments? Any way that you think organizations on the ground are really making an impact and using their agency and not just being passive in the whole situation?
Well, what's very interesting, I think, in Mexico is that the government is already educating younger children or in public schools about climate change and its effects and how, how it will change our future and their future mostly. So I think our hope still or our hope is very much with younger generations that are very, very active and very, very enthusiastic about doing something, and also very curious about finding ways to do so, trying to use all this enthusiasm and youth for the best and educate as much as we can, but also think about the bigger challenges and how today we can prepare for our future.
Yeah, and just for me, I think really think about how we can get the public sector to really collaborate with the private sector. The Beijing government is doing something amazing this year, and that they've disclosed that they're going to plant 1 million trees as part of gathering Barbados together and building our future kind of initiative. That looks primarily to be a platform for sustainability, essentially. And 1 million trees on kind of 466 square miles is quite small. So it's going to be a tough challenge. But I think what that's done is mobilize a lot of private sector companies to, as like a company day, go and plant trees. So it's kind of transcended that boundary of, right, well, you know, each individual plants one tree. So I think that's also a great point to think about. How can we get the public and the private to really collaborate? Because that's what we need. We need everyone.
And those stories are incredible as well, because you can see how it creates an impact on community bonding and cohesion. And that tackles other things like, you know, violence and crime that we know are impacting developing countries often in the headlines more so than climate change. So yeah, thanks so much for sharing your stories and for spending time with me in the studio today. Green Minds, look out for our next episode.